Welcome to part two of our interview with Christian Damiano, Beverage Operations Manager for Potawatomi Bingo Casino.
You'd mentioned that you seem to have a leaning toward California at this point. Is that right?
Wow. We've definitely grown the list as far as our California selections are concerned. We still have a very broad Italian base. Again, I got to go back to what I started off with. Great French wine, great Aussie wines. I would say probably my big focus over the last 3 or 4 years has been Oregon. And just I absolutely adore not only the wine that they're making out there, but the people themselves in the Willamette Valley are fantastic. It's a genuine switch and state of mind when it comes to the Oregonian winemakers. They're much more of a community, and they really do come together. You'll have an opportunity to talk to someone like Jason Lett, whose father basically started the Oregon, wine program and Pinot Noir. Papa Pino is what he's known David Lett. And Jason will go and say, if you're talking to him, you're tasting some of his wine, you'll say, hey, why don't you go visit Allison Alex Sokolblasser. See what they're doing. They're doing some really fun things with – they're blending some Syrahs or something with some Pinot and Zin. And then they'll say, well, why don't you go over to go visit Penarache because they're doing some fun things. And then you'll find out that the community really comes together really nicely. And if somebody's having a problem, it's not, well, good, you're having a problem because that means that I'm going to sell more wine. You guys are going to have a bad year. No. Everybody comes together and really – makes things happen for each other. And if somebody's having a problem, they're like, okay, well, this is what I saw this problem last year, so this is what I did to correct it. Give this a try. Or hey, you're you need another open tank fermenter. I've got an extra one here. You can borrow it. And that sense of community is something that you don't see in California. And I guess that's probably why I've been a bit passionate about Oregon as of late.
I could tell, but they are doing some great things as they are in Washington State. But Oregon really does seem to stand out, especially when it comes to Pinot and certainly Chardonnay as well. And I had seen something that you had done this, was it a Pinot boot camp, something like that?
Yes, Pinot camp. It was really a great experience. Pinot camp is one of those things that you have to be – you're invited to go to. And you come in and it's basically 4 days of – I think there were 90 different vineyards all running it, and it's run every year. And it's for people who are passionate, who are in the business. If you want to learn more about what we're doing here, and we would learn about the different soil structures, we'd learn about different styles of winemaking. We'd learn about, hey, we're going to try to do something with we're doing something here with Furstenmeiner. We're doing something with Riesling. It isn't all about Pinot Noir, but with our Pinot Noir, here's what's fantastic about Oregon. And it was a wonderful education, and got to meet a lot of really fun people.
Yeah, I'll bet. It's the continuing education of wine. Have you gone to any other? I mean, obviously we know about California, Washington, Oregon, and certainly New York State, areas like that. But any other parts of the country you've visited that you would talk about that you've been impressed by their wine?
Wow. Places that you wouldn't necessarily think of. Really great sparkling wine out of New Mexico. I mean, look at what they do with Gruet and New Mexico sparkling wine, really, but they've got some really fun rosés. There's been some really interesting things, even in Texas, of all people who have had a chance to meet and taste their wine. Santana Dotson's family owns a vineyard in Texas, and they're doing some really fantastic dessert wine. Yeah, it's you just.
I wouldn't expect dessert wine from Texas, though.
No, I mean, not at all. You're like, really?
All due respect.
Let me give this a try. We'll give it a go. And there are a lot of different vineyards all across the country. But I would say, again, right, as of late, my passion's definitely been Oregon.
That's okay. No, I understand that. On the dessert wine in Texas, what grapes are they making it from? Is it?
It's white Riesling.
Oh.
And. Yeah, I was. We're pretty impressed.
I bet you that's tasty.
It was unique. It's small production stuff, and sure. I believe they were working out a deal with I think Purple Feet Wine Company was the one that they were going to start importing it through, but I have not had a chance to see it yet here in Wisconsin, outside of the time that he actually came up to taste everyone on it. Like, hey, where's the wine?
I'm curious what a price point like that would be. Do you know what it was going
for? The half bottles were in the $23 to $26 range.
So it's a respectable price, but, mm-hmm. you know, not dirt cheap either. So
Correct.
As far as the Dream Dance Steak
sure.
Cellar, obviously you said French and, of course, U.S. and Italian. What other areas do you care? Australian, I believe you mentioned.
We've got a lot of Australian items, some things from South Africa, you know, Spain, Portugal, Lebanon.
Lebanon. You see these wines popping up on the shelves. Israel, actually some pretty good wines.
Oh, fantastic wine. One of my other large passions is with a vineyard called Chateau Musard. Gaston Hocquart was the original owner of winemakers, and his son, Serge Hocquart. I had an opportunity to meet him about 7 or 8 years ago. I came up and said, well, here, please try my wine. I'm like, wow, Lebanese wine. A little skeptical about something coming out of the Becca Valley, but I'm like, all right, well, let's give it a go. And then to learn more about the history, the wine that they produce at Chateau Musard is the traditionally methodically speaking, is French, because Gaston had a chance to study at Chateau Lafite, and that's where he developed the sense of pride in actually only utilizing the best grapes from the vintage. Number one, number two, he also had this great sense that wine must have age before it's consumed, because it's, you know, the young wine, he just didn't feel was ready to go. So he would not release anything until he felt that it was absolutely ready to be released. So he planted Cabernet Sauvignon, Cinsault, and Carignan for his red wine. And between picking, pressing, fermenting, it spends roughly a year in concrete, so nice and benign, something similar to what you'd find in, say, stainless steel. And then of course, French barriques, and it's only 30 to 50% of them are new, so the rest of them are older. Again, not imparting too much flavor. And that's it's all blended and then put into the French barrique, and then another year, and then it's bottled and cellared. So by the time everything's said and done, before it's actually released, there's 7 years of age on the wine. And the wine that is produced from Chateau Musard, the vintage Chateau Musard, is just this wonderful expression that gets brighter and younger as it ages. So a lot of wine, as it ages, you know, they have a tendency, you can definitely taste the fact that it's mature fruit. But somehow, some way, his wine truly becomes younger as it gets older. And I was like, okay, really, are you sure about this? And he's so, no, please taste these things. So I had an opportunity to taste all the way. He had, I think, 18 different vintages with him.
Wow.
And we had an opportunity to taste all the way back into the 1960s. And I was just blown away. It was amazing that it did. The wine truly becomes younger as it ages. And it's one of those bottles of wine, when you open it up and you taste it, you smell it, and then you come back to it, say, 15 minutes later, and it's a completely different wine. And it just makes you smile every time you taste it. So that's that's Serge Hocquart and now his son Gaston. So it was Gavin, Gaston, Serge, Gaston. They just do some really fantastic things. As a matter of fact, I had an opportunity when I first met him to purchase wine directly from the vineyard, and they shipped it through our distributor, which is great. So I ended up getting some back vintages. I think I've got vintages that go back to 1967.
Oh, nice. What an honor it is to be able to have those wines of that age. Now, are they in Dream Dance Steak Cellar? Are they in your personal cellar?
The wines of that age are definitely in Dream Dance Steak Cellar.
I'd like to think one or two are maybe in your cellar. Well, no, I shouldn't ask that.
No, I've had an opportunity, I think But because of the community that we have here, and we were able to taste a lot of different things, I hooked up with one or two retailers and was able to buy some items retail and continue to do so every so often. So I think I've got some vintages at home that go back to 91, 94, 96, 99.
Nice.
So every once in a while I get to open up one of those bottles and share it with friends who have turned on to it.
Well, that's why you do what you do, I imagine, other than the fact this is how you make your living.
This is true.
It's all about having fun. I mean, you should have fun in the way you make your living. That's the way to live, I would agree.
Right? Otherwise, it's just a job. Right. And jobs are monotonous. You got to have fun.
Well, and to kind of go back to this idea of wine from Lebanon, when you and I sat and chatted just before the interview today, we talked about the idea of having prejudices or having, you know, this idea of wine snobbery, which mm-hmm. obviously you are against wine snobbery. This idea of being open-minded, regardless of the country or the area, whatever it might be, there are places all over the planet making fabulous wine.
Exactly. That's the things that if you don't have that open mind, you really can't give yourself that type of palate education. And you know, going back to your comment about wine snobbery is that's one of the things that I work at every day to make sure that we are not being wine snobs. And that's one of the things that I always talk to you with all of my team members. I said, listen, you know, enjoy what you enjoy, especially when I get somebody who's brand new, who hasn't had the opportunity to really maybe taste a lot of different things and they don't necessarily know what they like and they're kind of scared about it because, well, okay, Christian, you're a certified sommelier and it's, you know, I don't want to look stupid. I'm like, no, stop. No, that's not what this is about. And then you start talking about, okay, well, what do you like? What do you like to drink? What kind of flavor profiles? And then you start somebody with something new and, okay, what did you like about it? Okay, if you like, I like the fact that there's maybe this little bit of sweetness to it, or this is what I use. Or if somebody tells me, hey, by the way, my favorite wine in the world is White Zinfandel, I'm like, all right, there's a starting point. Let's try something a little bit different, but along that guideline. But if you enjoy White Zinfandel, you know, God bless you, enjoy it.
Well, it's a journey.
And, it is.
And we all started somewhere, whether it was in the dreaded days of Ripple and Boone's Farm, somewhere along the line, or maybe the days of Kenai even, or whatever. You go down this path. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. I never used to touch late harvest or dessert wines. Now I'm crazy for them. It's all about being open-minded.
It truly is. Dessert wines, there's one of those things that people get extremely passionate about. Either they truly enjoy them, where they think, oh no, it's dessert wine. It's too sweet. I'm not going to drink that. But man, if you don't try that, you're completely missing out on an entire experience, entire flavor profiles. And just because something might be a little bit sweet, doesn't mean that it has this dry orange nuance to it that you wouldn't have necessarily picked up. Or it's a fantastic sherry that has this great nuttiness to it that just because you're biased to quote unquote dessert wine, you're never going to be able to experience that. And hey, by the way, I'm going to match this great dessert wine with this dessert. And we're gonna pair things up. And now you're telling me, no, I'm not going to try the dessert wine? And you're missing out on half the experience.
The best thing is to be able to try it. I think the same thing can apply towards sparkling wines and champagnes. That some people are kind of like, I'm not going to try that. And then maybe you start trying it and you start working your way into it and all of a sudden you've discovered one more alley down this incredible landscape.
Absolutely. And the fun thing is that not only do you discover that alley, you might find another offshoot of it. So for me, I love sparkling wine. Sparkling wine is fantastic. It's great for pairing. It's especially if you've got a couple of people that are on the cusp. They don't know exactly what they want to do, and like, okay, well, it's good pairing wine. For me personally, trying different styles of sparkling wine makes the most sense in the world. And to try something that goes through late disgorgement, something that has a little bit more yeast to it, and just a little bit of bread on the nose, and yet it's still sparkling and clean. That's what I dig. I really like that.
This is true sommelier talking like this. This is what I'm enjoying. This is so much fun to hear you talk like that because you have this whole world at your fingertips and you're able to talk about it very honestly because it's about the enjoyment of the fruit.
Sure. And all different aspects. Let's go back to the sparkling wine, which we really haven't gotten off topic on. Muscat d'Asti. One of the things I truly enjoy Moscato d'Asti. I love it. It's fun. It's fresh. Summertime. It's fantastic. For my wedding, I had 9 cases of Moscato d'Asti that we used as our toast and passed around, and everyone enjoyed. And it was one of those things. It was at that point in time, for you know, the 150, 180 people we had, it was one of these universal things. It wasn't too dry. It wasn't too sweet. It was something that everyone was going to, and nobody felt foolish about. So it was definitely part of the party.
This is the end of part 2 of our interview with Kristen Damiano. Download part 3 from lifebetweenthevines.com or from iTunes.